Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs, right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Emma Watsky, coming to you from Radio Adelaide here in Tandunya, on the lands of Gunamina. Our team pays our deepest respect to Elders past, present and emerging. We extend this respect to all First Nations listeners and to the rightful custodians of the lands you're listening in from. And today on the show...
Yes, and Katrina, people saw firsthand that the United States doesn't care about Black people and whether or not Black people die. This is a majority African-American city. People were left to die here when there were plenty of resources to get them.
It's been 20 years since Hurricane Katrina's force cut through New Orleans, Louisiana, and coastal areas of Mississippi, its destruction leaving an undeniable legacy, with ripples of grief felt two decades on, particularly for Indigenous peoples. Also, thousands turned up for the March for Australia rallies over the weekend, creating controversy over event messaging and the impact on migrant communities. And later,
issues that we have that we struggle through, and being a migrant myself and being in Australia for so long, I think it was not easy for my parents, wasn't easy for me.
A growing need to support Pacific Islanders and multicultural inmates in prison and immigration detention centres has seen one woman awarded for her efforts. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. We're on air across Australia, thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up, is our country one step closer to an independent centre for disease control? After many questions and decades of discussion, legislation to establish the country's first permanent Australian centre of disease control is now before the federal parliament. If passed, the agency aims to be opening its doors at the start of 2026. The Wire's Zachary Probert spoke with Manager of Policy and Advocacy at the Public Health Association of Australia, Malcolm Bauman, to discuss this further.
Almost all major developed nations have a Centre for Disease Control. It's a concentration of the expertise in research and in detection of disease movements and in response and in policy advice to governments. And in reaction to epidemics, of course, we just went through the biggest one in world history 5 years ago. And the curious thing is that Australia has never had one. Every other country in the world in some clusters have got, every other developed country have got a CDC. My organisation and others have been seeking one since the 1980s. And we're delighted that Australia will finally have one established on 1st of January.
You just mentioned the timeline of establishing the CDC. What exactly did that look like and why did it kind of take a while for it to get established?
So the Albanese government made this an election commitment before their election in 2022. Back in 2021, they made this promise to create a CDC. It's taken a little time. We've been patient or impatient, perhaps, but the government made an announcement last year that it was finally ready to go with a permanent legislative body, and they set the final timeline of starting the agency on the 1st of January 2026 next year. What's happened this week is that the Minister for Health, Mark Butler, has introduced into Parliament the legislation to formally create it. And we very much hope and believe they can meet that timeline. They have had an interim body running for about 18 months as a division of the Health Department. That's good. So they should be ready to go on 1st January next year.
You also mentioned how a CDC can help with endemics, pandemics, and things like that. Obviously, we just saw that with COVID. Can this help with any future pandemics that may occur?
Absolutely. It can help with future pandemics. Nobody doubts there'll be more national-based epidemics or international pandemics occurring. No one imagines that won't happen. This will put us in a better state of readiness. I should say that the Commonwealth Government ran a major review in 2024 into how we went managing COVID, and that was released in October 2024. And in amongst a range of recommendations on what to do to prepare us for next time, was the creation of a CDC to be the coordinator of our response. So it's the fulfillment of that recommendation as well coming out of that inquiry. So we just need to be stronger than we perhaps were 5 years ago in preparedness for pandemics, in knowing how to react quickly, in knowing how to take the public with government decision-making, building up trust in the way we're doing responses. That's what a CDC is for. That's why we should be pleased to have one starting early next year.
What other aspects of our society can benefit from having an organisation like this?
Yeah, it's important to note that a CDC does not just deal with communicable diseases, infections, things like COVID. When we speak of diseases, there are two kinds, the communicable and the non-communicable. And among non-communicable are all the long-term chronic illnesses we suffer from, some of them driven by preventable factors like our diet or drugs or tobacco, etc., others more or less endemic. We think that about a third of all preventable non-communicable disease in Australia is simply preventable by changes in practice and policy and what we eat and all those sorts of things. And around the world, CDCs always deal with both. One of the things we're going to have to face with the CDC being created in Australia is that it is not yet being given a mission to deal with that second half. We'll be discussing that with government as things unfold. The Public Health Association of Australia and many others are absolutely adamant we must deal with chronic diseases as well as epidemic communicable disease outbreaks.
Looking at how other CDCs in other countries, namely the US, have kind of had major funding cuts in recent history, has the government provided any protections or commitments to maintaining the CDC in the future?
So the government's legislating for a permanent body, and that's to be welcomed. All countries around the world have a CDC. You did mention in one case, the United States, things don't seem to be going well. The Trump administration is imposing, and for context, the American CDC is the biggest and best research factory of public health knowledge in the world. It's the biggest of the CDCs, and other countries, let's be frank, have relied on it over the decade. The Trump administration is cutting its funding, sacking its leadership, and generally making its staff feel very politically unloved by that administration. I don't think we have anything like the same culture in Australia. Our government and generally our public trust the public health expertise that we have in this country. But as for the independence of the CDC in Australia, I think what they're going to create is a leadership of this organisation which will be capable of speaking truth to government. We're confident that that is going to happen. And I think it's for the rest of us to make sure we never have an administration quite as untrusting of public health as the Trump administration is. You know, in a sense, it's our job as democratic citizens to protect our organisations from that kind of political attack. I don't think the government can legislate away the kind of things that is happening in the United States. So I think their arrangements will probably be quite adequate in the first instance on this.
Manager of Policy and Advocacy at the Public Health Association of Australia, Malcolm Bauman, speaking with Zachary Probert.
Have you checked out The Wire? It's your national current affairs program. The Wire, taking an independent look at what's happening in Australia and around the world. Fresh voices, new points of view, current affairs with a difference. Don't miss The Wire, daily on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
It's been 20 years since images of people clinging to the roofs of homes were broadcast across the world. August 29, 2005 saw the powerful Category 5 storm, Hurricane Katrina, cut through Louisiana, causing major destruction and loss of life. One of the hardest hit cities was Bulbancha. Bulbancha is the Choctaw Chickasaw word for the site where New Orleans now sits. Its name was used by several Indigenous groups that used the site for trading prior to colonisation. The hurricane's 20th anniversary comes at a time when the Trump administration is making cuts to disaster aid and to FEMA, the agency that looks after disasters. Local Jeffrey Darensberg is from the Takapoisha Nation of Southwest Louisiana and Southeast Texas. NERS News' Rihanna Patrick asked Jeffrey about the feelings in Bulbancha in the lead-up to today.
There is just so much mourning, and many people I know who had just terrific, horrifying encounters during the storm and trying to escape are reliving that. And several people I know, people very close to me, are really traumatized by it. It's a time where many people are reflecting on what happened during the storm, what actually made it worse, and what things happened after the storm to the city that have made the city worse. And that is really what this time is for, I think, for many people. And then just so many people just thinking about people they lost, homes they lost, people thinking about places that are still here but aren't the same anymore, neighborhoods that have gentrified since then, institutions that have passed away or transformed in ways that are unrecognizable, and a number of events, performances, remembrances, etc. I would say other than French colonization of the city, you know, 300 plus years ago, it is the single most important event that has happened here. And it has left a tremendous legacy.
What do you remember about that time 20 years ago?
Well, I was distant from here. I was doing my PhD at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Many of my family members here were fleeing. Some of them fled to Dallas and never returned. After what happened, they never wanted to come back. Others of them decided to stay, came with relatives in other places in Louisiana. My great uncle, who died last year, I think he was age 102 when he died, he was one of a number of people who stayed, didn't know how bad it would be, ended up being trapped on top of his house, had to be rescued. And he worked for the New Orleans Saints football team, who eventually reconnected to him at a refugee shelter in San Antonio and sent him back to us. But we thought he was dead. There are a number of my friends who, you know, lost all of their possessions. One of my closest collaborators, you know, had 8 feet of water in his house. That was really common. And there were houses that disappeared or houses that moved to a different block. And then there were, of course, the aftermath, in which neoliberalism played a major role, where people used disaster capitalism, in other words, using an emergency to enact policies that were unpopular to dramatically change the city. A lot of people don't know, the public school teachers here were all fired in order to break a union. At this stage, the city has only charter schools, which are like private contractors. We don't have regular public schools. Our trash collection is privatized. The city is whiter than it was. There are neighborhoods that have changed their ethnic demographic. I find the city also is not as much late night. It used to be more 24-hour institutions here. And the city is dramatically more expensive than it used to be. It used to be a place that was kind of run down, but kind of a rundown bohemia where you could go and live and enjoy culture that didn't fit into the norm, a place where people could go. When you didn't fit in anywhere else, you would probably fit in here. And some of that has changed over time. And it's something that is concerned. There are many cultural institutions here, parades and musical institutions that are based in particular neighborhoods. And now the people involved in some of those institutions can't afford to live in those neighborhoods anymore. And that's a direct result of what happened after Katrina. That's some of the negative stuff. There's also the positive aspect in that, yes, in Katrina, people saw firsthand that the United States doesn't care about Black people and whether or not Black people die. This is a majority African-American city. People were left to die here when there were plenty of resources to get them. And yet, after the next storm, the next biggest storm, Hurricane Ida, which I lived through here in 2021, many more people were involved in what are known as mutual aid groups. In other words, loosely organized groups of citizens who would pool resources and try to help their neighbors. And especially with widespread use of the internet, people relaying information about where to get food, where to get clothes, where to get housing assistance. And I think that a lot of that was just that people lost faith in the ability of the government to help them. Not that we didn't get government help during Hurricane Ida.
Indigenous resident Jeffrey Darensberg from Bulbancha, New Orleans, speaking with National Indigenous Radio Service's Rihanna Patrick. Over the weekend, March for Australia rallies emerged in all corners of the country, seeing events in some states roll out in the thousands, protesting for what organisers presented as preservation of Australian identity. But amid crowds, neo-Nazi members were prominent, according to reports, with events linked to far-right white nationalist ideologies, leaving fringe ideals now pushed further into mainstream view. In the aftermath, migrant groups and migration experts point to rising hate speech, racism, and growing misinformation. I spoke with President of Turbans for Australia, Amar Singh, to find out his thoughts in the lead-up.
Look, I had some general concerns before the rally sort of took place, but I think it only reinforced those concerns once we saw neo-Nazis at the rally being given front and centre and a lot of hate speech against migrants and Indians. This is just not on. This is not what Australia is built on. Australia is a multicultural, diverse nation that prouds itself as a place that represents the world in the ecosystem in the south, you know, southern hemisphere of the globe. And this goes against every principle that we have as Australia.
And, you know, these rallies really blew out. I think the numbers were higher than first anticipated. There have been reports that these turnouts pushed that attention around the far-right nationalist ideals from the fringe to more mainstream. So it's put that anti-immigration narrative in the spotlight. What impact has this had on your community with these messages circulating?
Well, I wouldn't really say that they were really overly successful. I mean, I think, you know, 30,000 people across the country or so, whatever the figures have been quoted in different media outlets, it's not really a huge size of our proportion of our population. So I don't think it's that much of a worry. But what we're worried about are the sort of the hate preachers getting their airtime, encouraging other people to join them or follow with their mission of, you know, there was clearly, I think one of the organisers in Sydney was caught up saying with a radio media interview that she was calling for violence. And that sort of is the concern, that they're encouraging other people to do the wrong thing. So I'm not really overly concerned with their numbers because they're quite small relatively compared to our population. But the migration debates, it's got to be had. But then you've got to look at an average migrant who arrives in Australia at a 20-year-old, for example, with English as a second or third language or sometimes no English skills, can still get a job, get a life together. And an average 20-year-old born in Australia that knows the culture, knows the language, knows everything around the system, why can't they go for the same job?
And can you tell me perhaps a little bit about your story and background living in Australia?
Definitely. Look, I arrived in Australia when I was a 15-year-old from India, and I call Australia home since then. I've been a citizen since 2000. I've spent more time of my life in Australia than anywhere else in the world, and this is my home. And that's what really concerns me, that people are being targeted for their race or ethnicity in these sort of hate speech rallies, which is just not on. And I think my story is one of the, I guess, the thousands and the millions of other migrants who came before me and who come in the future as well. It's one of those that they work hard and build their life together. They are given the same opportunity as anyone else, but it depends on the individual to take up those opportunities and cash in and work hard to make it work.
What sorts of things have you heard from your community, maybe from international students or people on working visas in response to this event?
It has been a period of concern for many migrants and Australian citizens. I've had my friends or acquaintances from work and charity sector who are Australians married to, say, Indian or other migrants, and their partners have been concerned about going out on the last weekend, thinking, you know, what if they get targeted or attacked? And that's a big hit on our democratic multicultural society, that an average Aussie, no matter what background they're from, are concerned about stepping a foot outside their door.
I have actually heard of a few or several reports of online trolling that has emerged from these rallies, you know, with quite negative comments. What are you or your organisation, are you offering support to your community or doing things to protect your community?
Yeah, definitely. Look, I think the online trolling and thing hasn't gone away. I have been personally tagged in I don't know how many posts by people just saying, you know, putting up the post and other things. But that's okay. You know, this is the price you pay for leading a community through turbulent times and saying no to hate. So I'm all okay with it. But there's other people who take it personally who really feel fragile after seeing these comments or posts. And I advise them to seek help through Lifeline or reach out to us to see if you can arrange any counselling for them. And we have been talking to many people who have felt very uncomfortable in their social media or even their friends targeting them because they put up a certain post. Like, I'm all for people having a protest and their democratic right to have be a part of a protest. But if the protest is going to preach hate against any community, then it's not okay.
The anti-immigration protesters claimed that immigration is at an all-time high, but Australia's immigration figures say otherwise. Migration experts say they're definitely not at a record high. What do you think needs to be done, I guess, to get to the truth of this rather than tout misinformation?
But look, in the era of social media, misinformation and disinformation is always easier to spread. And a lot of times when people are emotionally charged, they just look at a post that resonates with the current emotion, and then they sort of share it and send it out to friends. And that's how this misinformation spreads. But the reality is the migration numbers that are there, I mean, I'm not registered migrant agent or anything, but I mean, I think, you know, sensible migration, and more needs to be done on housing locally, because you can't expect a migrant to bring in housing. We have an aging population. We need doctors, we need teachers, we need trade. How are they going to come? A lot of people started off from the ground and worked their way up. Now everyone wants to be handed something on a silver platter. That is not right.
President of Turbans for Australia, Amar Singh, speaking with me.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
In 2013, Raewyn Burton saw the need to support Pacific Islanders and multicultural inmates in prison and immigration detention centres. Back then, she made the decision to help out. Since, Ms. Burton has forged pathways within correctional centres and organisations that don't often engage in cross-cultural conversations. She's also supported new migrants with services for food, accommodation, and legal aid. On Friday, she received the Multicultural Sector Outstanding Achiever at the Multicultural Queensland Awards. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan has the story.
Yeah, nervous. I won't lie to you. But very, very excited and very proud to be here tonight to represent the work that's been done and, you know, to be here with other multicultural communities and amazing people who've been doing some amazing things. Yeah.
Now, could you please tell us a little bit more about how you started volunteering in correctional centres?
Yeah, so that was, it's always been a heart of mine to work with people who were in corrections, and I've been doing it right across the Pacific and in New South Wales as well as Queensland for probably the better part of the last 30 years. And so when I came to Queensland, there was a bit of a call out from a person in our Fijian community who was needing some assistance and also just needing help in general. And that was pretty huge. So we, you know, decided to go out and see what that looked like. And from there, that's where I pretty much started at Southern Queensland Correctional Centre back in 2013. And from there, it just, we saw the need was great. And we just continued to engage. When I say we, it was myself and a friend of mine, Leo, who has now passed on. And he was from the Samoan community. And I always acknowledge him because if it wasn't for him, we probably wouldn't have continued to do it because, you know, going on your own is a bit scary to those sorts of things. And then from there, the more we saw the need, the more we just continued to engage and we started to see some amazing results. And, it's pretty much how it went. From there, it went to two jails, to three jails, to four jails. And then there was an amazing call out to immigration detention when we saw some changes in federal legislation and the needs that were surrounding our Pacific people at the time.
Well, I'm pretty sure you will have in your thoughts your friend that helped you to pave the way to be here today. So I'm sorry for your loss, but it's great that he will be with you as well. Also, in what ways do you also support new migrants, and what do they say about your support in general, and what do they say about Australia?
So with migrants in general, I think there's some of those assimilation issues that we have that we struggle through, and being a migrant myself and being in Australia for so long, I think it was not easy for my parents, wasn't easy for me. So I think some of the pitfalls and some of the things that I went through that I've now come through, I think would be of use to migrants who are going through the same issues and concerns. There's all sorts of barriers, language, understanding, just basically not knowing what to do, where to go, and where to find that information was probably one of the biggest things. Talking to migrants now it's a lot easier for me to help them to understand, knowing where I've come from and being around it for so long. So, yeah, they love Australia, but obviously just finding their way is a big thing. Yeah.
It's the biggest issue for new migrants like you and me, you know. True. Finding out the way, I mean, it's difficult. But Ray, what are the plans for the future to continue supporting multicultural communities?
Yeah, so there's, for me, I'm always looking for where there's more need. I think at the moment there are many issues that are facing our communities, and I think one of the biggest things for me at the moment is the ageing population of our migrants, and I'm starting to look more into what that looks like and what we know and what we don't know and how to be able to communicate that right across and to assist. Obviously, Australia, we are dealing with an ageing population in general, but for some of our migrant families that came earlier in the piece or even now who have aging parents or grandparents, that's a big issue for me at the moment, and looking into how we can best support and navigate that system as well.
Collaboration support worker and winner at the Multicultural Queensland Awards, Raywin Burton, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Emma Watsky from Radio Adelaide here in Tandunya. Stay tuned for tomorrow's show, brought to you from 4EB in Melbourne. The Wire is a weekday co-production between 2SER in Gadigal, Sydney, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Meanjin, Brisbane, and Melbourne, and Radio Adelaide with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can also hop online to check out our stories at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you tomorrow evening on The Wire.